They call us the irregulars, but baby, we're always on time. Baker Street babes always leave the rest of them behind. Oh. So when Scotland Yard they send you home, you feel like you're losing your quotidian world has got you crying. Won't you two, one, mine?
So we're gathered here for a tree support group. All the trees that lost their lives in Game of Shadows. They didn't know what they were getting into.
I mean, if you're listening to the podcast, you probably know. You probably have seen the movie already. But there was a lot of harassment. Trees harassment.
Tree harassment.
In my opinion, they were asking for it, just growing there in the woods, all tall, bark on the outside with the leaves. They wanted it coming. They had it coming.
They were in Germany. They should have known projectiles were going to be them.
Exactly.
Sorry, Artie.
What are you doing in Germany, tree, if you're not asking to have bullets shatter your...
German trees, what the hell? So that's kind of a good starter for... A review of Game of Shadows.
Richie hates trees. It is now a hashtag and everyone should use it.
In memoriam.
Join us on Twitter, Richie hates trees. That's what we're doing right now. So yeah, so basically I think all of us quite like the movies.
I'm just going to go and say this is not a spoiler-free podcast. So if you haven't seen the movie, stop right now. Just hit stop.
Call.
Just stop. Right now. Stop.
Stop. Stop. Don't.
My little sister is going to see it tonight, and it was funny, because I'm like, oh god, and there's Reichenbach. So she's like, what's Reichenbach? I'm like, oh god!
Shut up!
No, like, because I've introduced her to, like, Sherlock. She's like, she's addicted to Sherlock and Doctor Who and everything now, so I'm doing a really good job as a big sister.
Yay.
But she hasn't read the story, so she doesn't know. I'm just like, oh my god, you're going to be so upset when you come home. Because I told her, I'm like, oh, Sherlock season two, it ends in Reichenbach. She's like, what's that? I'm like, you'll find out.
I had a bit of a laugh. I think I saw it passing by on Tumblr. Someone had written a message after seeing the movie saying, ho, 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 the people from the Sherlock Holmes movie have been watching the BBC show because at one point Sherlock gives, Holmes gives a message to Watson saying, come if convenient. And someone said, well, maybe someone has read the canon to begin with.
Yeah.
And I'm like, okay, we still have a major gap. So that was quite interesting.
Did you love, though, how much canon was in that movie? There were all these little dribs and drabs here and there, like at the very beginning where Watson is typing up the case that is going to be the final problem.
Yes, he had the stock magazine there.
Yes, at his elbow is his draft of, I think it was Blue Carbuncle, I don't quite recall. It was a draft of one of the famous adventures of Sherlock Holmes, which is completely canonical because the Adventures of Sherlock Holmes, according to the chronology, only started being published in the Strand after Sherlock Holmes was already dead. The only ones that had appeared before that were Study in Scarlet and The Sign of Four. So chronologically speaking, it was, like, fantastic. Like, that was really cool that he has his, that once Holmes is gone, all he's thinking about is typing up their story.
There were lots of little nods like that in there, and it's kind of like it makes me want to just go and see it again just for that, really. Yeah.
I'm guilty as charged. I've seen it two times already.
I went to the midnight showing, and when we first got there, like, no one was there, because we went where the University of Maryland is, so it was finals week, so we're like, no one's going to be here. So we had the theater to ourselves for quite a while, then some other people came in, but it was so funny. Like, my friend and I, like, we're totally both Sherlock Holmes geeks, and we're just, like, laughing and, like, pointing things out, like, oh, did you see that? Did you see that? Like, the come if convenient thing, we, like, started flailing in our seats.
Yeah, I went with Fangirls, we did a murder mystery dinner party beforehand.
Aww.
And pretty brilliant. And throughout the whole film, we were just, there were seven of us. And yeah, we were pretty flaily.
I was by myself the first time I saw it. I went to see it at noon in the cinema. We were like 10 people in there.
Nice.
And there were moments where I just wanted to turn towards someone and say, did you see that? And there was no one. Nobody. It was a bit sad. So I went home and then I tweet.
Yeah.
Just explode with a very strange vocabulary. Made of strange flaily noises. And that's about it. But no, I really enjoyed it. I mean, I saw it 2 times. So now I have, the first time I saw it on Friday, I was really giddy about the whole thing. And I saw it again last night. And I kind of watched it with a more, cinema, critic kind of eye.
I saw your feelings about that.
I'm still kind of, I think it's a really, really fun film as well. I mean, it's obviously a blockbuster and it works really well as it is. Mm-hmm. I still have a bit of issues with, I mean, I'm sorry if someone hears that, but I still have a bit of issues with Richie's directing. I know it's on and off depending on people, but I think sometimes it's a bit of the easy route. And I'm not really sure he can direct Robert Downey Jr. because Robert Downey Jr., when he's unleashed, it's pretty much on his own. Like, you know, he's by himself. And I think it's very obvious at the beginning of the film. And the first 45 minutes, it's like, it's the line between Downey Jr. and Sherlock Holmes is so blurry sometimes.
Yeah.
And then it kind of gets momentum later on. I love the last hour. It's brilliant.
Well, and I tend to think that Richie's responsible for everything because in the film world, the director technically sort of is responsible for everything.
Oh, yeah.
But I was talking to Les Klinger recently about, you know, some of my opinions of just the universe of the Richie films, and he was saying, well, you know, a lot of that, he's not an auteur, part of that is Lionel Wigram, part of that is, you know, the people who are screenwriting, and I had objections to it too, all kinds of things. I mean, I have severe objections to a couple of the aspects of that film, no matter how much I loved it. Like, I really, really liked it, but I think it has serious problems in a couple of aspects, and I don't know how much of that can be put on Richie. Like, I think as far as directing, Robert Downey Jr., amazingly charismatic and incredible, and that makes sense. But some of it, I kind of want to know, like, who to point a finger at, where this movie is about. Does that make sense?
Whose fault is this?
Well, who fridged Irene Adler? Who fridged her?
I know, right?
Who? It's like, you killed Irene Adler. What the hell?
Yeah.
It makes sense in the universe, I suppose, because, like, the tying up the loose ends sort of thing. So it made sense in the context of the story, but, like, that part of you is just like, what did you do? Why did you...
Yeah.
They
could have handled it so much better.
It's still one of the things, I don't know, I might make a very big statement there, but knowing Richie's filmography from before as well, it does a lot of guy-dominated movies by default. And I think, you know, there was an opportunity to write kind of cool woman characters. I personally think Marie is actually quite cool. She's not a lot on screen, but I kind of like the kind of calm presence she has. And understanding. I think Kelly Reilly is a great actress as well. And I think she gets it right in this kind of, especially like the wedding scene. Like she comes, you know, she just faces Watson and she barely blinks at him, knowing he's completely changed. Something happened during the night. She looks at him, she looks at Holmes and she knows, and there is nothing more to that. And I quite like the fact that she's kind of, and she's enduring it, but in a very peaceful manner, which I quite enjoy. But I think the other two female characters, Iran and Semsa, it was kind of like, it could have been more, you know. I think Noomi Rapace is fucking brilliant. Oops, I swear.
Dude, it does not fucking matter if you swear.
Oh, yeah. I keep trying to get
censorship.
Yeah, well. Noomi Rapace is fucking amazing, and she's really cool, and I think she could have had more, but she wasn't so bad. I think Irene was probably the worst, because I don't really understand how Irene of all people would be so easily played in a way.
I know, she's smarter than that.
Well, let's take it like one at a time, so we're not jumping around everywhere.
Yeah.
Sounds like fun.
Because you know how in all the previews they showed the kiss and everyone was getting really angry? And I like that in the movie it actually isn't like a mutual kiss. It's Sherlock being awkward and being like, I'm getting this out of your pocket, and going, So I appreciated that, but I am upset about what they did to her.
Yeah.
Could have been handled better. Yeah.
There is a part of me that kind of think that when from the moment she doesn't get the letter and she goes to meet Moriarty at the cafe, and everyone leaves because he owns the whole cafe suddenly.
That was pretty funny.
That was a really cool scene though. I don't know, there was something that was like, I think she would have known because she was so in depth of him in the first movie already. Like, he makes it really clear that he basically owns her with this thing. I would have expected her to kind of have a double twisted kind of second plan that she could have escaped with. And she just go into the trap and that's about it. I mean, I would have, as Irene, I would have never drunk anything at all from the...
I think that's why she asked for the second cup.
Yeah, but even
it didn't matter. And I guess.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, fridging women is just never cool, and it was quite disappointing. Yeah. And in my head, because of a fig I read, I think is one of the first that's actually been posted about this film. She actually had Blackwood's formula, and she just faked it because she's badass like that. That's kind of the only way that I can make it work in my head, because it just does not fit at all with the Irene that I know. It just doesn't add up.
Yeah, I agree 100% with that. And I think that for the purposes of that character in that film, they could have been using literally any, it could have been anyone, it could have been any character. Those lines and that setup bore no resemblance to the woman who is the badass and who outwits Sherlock Holmes. If she can outwit Sherlock Holmes and Sherlock Holmes can outwit James Moriarty, then what are we talking about? There's no point to putting... It's just fridging, plain and simple, and I got into a conversation about this on the internet recently, and I think it's cheap and lazy, and I don't like that aspect of the screenplay. I wish that she hadn't appeared in the film at all, and they had to bring her back for, you know, the third one as an interesting character, as a character that makes sense, because she outwits Sherlock Holmes in the canon, and it's the formula just doesn't add up that she would be this package delivery girl. It does in the Richieverse, and I'm more and more starting to think of the whole Richieverse. I did before, but now it's really clear in my head. This isn't even Victorian England we're talking about. We're talking about
steampunk land.
It's steampunk land. And what this is like Holmes, Watson, Mary, Irene, but no longer Irene, and etc. in steampunk land, and I need to just calm down about it, because otherwise my brain will leak out of my ears. Does anybody care that train conductors don't keep driving trains after cars are blown off the back?
They had a deadline, Lindsay. They had to make that.
Right, clearly I'm being
this is
overcommitting to the world,
The one thing that I thought was okay about Irene dying was the moment on the boat with the handkerchief. For some reason, that just really struck a chord with me, and I got, like, really upset. I think you talked about this already in your review, that it's pretty much you put Holmes through the ringer, and everything bad that could possibly happen to him happens to him. You just watch it, like, disintegrate him.
Yeah, it's like, you know, his closest friend is moving out and, you know, is not going to be with him anymore. The woman that he loved dies and, you know, he gets injured and he gets tortured. And it's just like the screenwriters actually sat down and were like, how many ways can we break Sherlock Holmes? And I did like that Irene was a factor in that, but I didn't like the way that it was done because, it just didn't. It didn't fit.
Right. So this is basically the Empire Strikes Back of the Richie Holmes, right?
Yeah, that's it.
This is what it is. This is what it's about. When you think about it, they want to do a third movie, and it just follows the usual Campbell stuff, which is, you know, we have the first step, we're doing the second step, which is generally the darker, and then the next one, I have no idea what it's going to be now.
Campbell, it's the hero must die, the hero must, I don't know, for context, I wrote my senior English thesis on this, by the way, Joseph Campbell, as applies to the Sherlock Holmes canon. So Joseph Campbell wrote a book called Hero with a Thousand Faces, and Hero with a Thousand Faces is a natural progression from Jung, and Jung had posited that the collective unconscious creates hero stories that are remarkably similar from culture to culture, that there's a Cinderella story in every culture, that that these classic tales repeat themselves no matter where you come from, and that it's impossible, this is what he posits, that it's impossible that that could have happened by accident. So Campbell then took it and sort of codified the heroic figure into particular characteristics, all of which apply to the Sherlock Holmes stories. The hero has talismans, like, well, the magnifying glass is probably the most prominent. It's actually canon. The hero fights monks. The hero creates order where there was once chaos. The hero dies. Ultimately, the hero dies, and then the hero returns from the dead in Campbell's vision of things. And it absolutely, it's like a, you know, Luke Skywalker, countless examples. Harry Potter as a Christ figure, that sort of thing. So you've got Harry Potter as a Christ figure. He dies, but he doesn't really. It's self-sacrificial so that his own society can continue and his own loved ones can be safe. So you're right. It's exactly that. Like, they were tapping into that concept for this screenplay, which a lot of people will be doing, and as very tellingly, Conan Doyle was not doing when he set out to kill Sherlock Holmes. That all turned into a complete accident. But yeah, I totally agree with Marie. It's myth-making. That's what they're doing at this point.
Mm. Okay, moving on. What about Simza? She wasn't what I expected her to be. I didn't expect her to be a gypsy, I suppose. But no, I think she was just sort of the female tag-along that sort of they felt necessary to put in there. Does that make sense?
Absolutely.
She wasn't so completely defenseless in when Holmes and her meet at the beginning. She was fighting back quite a lot, which I quite enjoy. Not enough, but, you know. I like the fact that Holmes makes a whole deduction about killing that assassin, and when he just grabs him, he just does two things, and then she just, blam, knives. And it was just brilliant, because I was like, yeah, way too good to just get into the picture, and it's actually
quite... That was a cool moment.
Yeah, that was really cool. But yeah, after that, it felt a bit like she was just tagging along, and it was a bit, I don't know.
Was anyone else in that moment reminded of Sarah and the Chinese circus?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. I'm not the only one. Brilliant.
Yeah. Well played. Well played. I'm sorry. I was saying the exact same thing you were. There's so little to say about her.
Yeah. Like, I think she's a good actress, and we will probably see a lot more of her in Hollywood. But as a character, I didn't particularly care about her plight or her brother, and we don't even need to talk about that. That was not a particularly... amazing twist.
I think I called it lame beyond words, and yeah.
Okay.
I'm gonna say it right now, not to sound like obnoxious or anything, but from the moment Holmes gave the letter with the drawing of him, I knew what was going to happen. Because I've seen a few movies recently that talks about, you know, people changing faces, and I sadly saw a lot of TV episodes about things as well on TV, and I don't know why, but as soon as he got the letter, I was like, oh my God, this is gonna be a guy that doesn't look the same. It's gonna be like a whole thing about surgery and everything, and I couldn't believe, I mean, I was, it's not gonna be that, and then at the end I was like, oh God, it actually was. I was like, oh no, it was just too easy. I watched too much TV.
Well, The Skin I Live In, is that the name of the film? That's very interesting.
Yeah, very awesome.
When did plastic surgery really start? Because it can't be that advanced in the late 19th century. I can't imagine.
A full facial transplant was only achieved, I think, because I remember when I saw that it had been. It's been within the last 2 years, I think, because it was all over the internet that somebody had achieved a full facial transplant and that it was amazing, I think. I don't know that it even... for all that long. It's not Victorian England. It's fairyland where you get to switch faces, do what you like. No, it's just very weird to me that I have to constantly adjust myself in terms of deductions that actually work in those films and science that either wasn't created yet or hasn't been yet created.
Yeah. This is where sort of the steampunk alternate universe comes in.
Yes, definitely.
Yeah.
I think this is where, you know, this is, you have to, suspend disbelief. You're just going to go in that place that is completely steampunk. And we see a lot in superheroes film right now. And as soon as you go back in history in the 40s and you have all these super villains who always have these amazing things happening during the war and this crazy scientists. And it's quite common to see it, so I guess it was just an easy way out for them to explain it. But yeah, well, easy twists, we agree.
Yeah. And also just like, really? Why? 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 Mm.
But then again, he was part of the Reichenbach scene, and that ends was just, I'm sorry, but I bloody loved it. It was just amazing.
Oh, I like it. Beautiful. Yeah.
The chess, the brain chess, I don't know how to call it anyway, but the whole scene with the build-up, like the acting between Jared Harris and Donnie Jr. and the music and everything, it was just amazing. I really, really loved it.
It's called Blind Chess or Double Blind Chess.
Okay, thank you.
I'd actually love to know more about that type of chess, just in sense of a metaphor, because watching it as someone who doesn't know about chess, I thought it was kind of a really obvious metaphor, although it was visceral and it worked quite well, but what kind of chess would they play?
I could only think of, like, wizard's chess, and I know it's terrible, but that's all I could think about.
Wizard chess.
Well, they had the clock, so it was blitz chess, and Moriarty was saying, you know, can you manage a 5-minute game? And you have the clocks that stop the time that you take for each turn that you take. And you have a limited time, not just for your whole game, but you have limited time for each turn. You have to tip the clock back within, I don't know, 10 seconds or some such. Mm. But then at the end, they kind of abandoned the board and just played in their heads. And that is called double blind chess. It's called blind chess if one of you has a board, and it's double blind chess if neither of you has a board, and you just play in your heads. And you, people play this with a third person, you know, as the kind of referee sort of person to, you know, make sure that their moves are actually plausible, but neither of them actually have a board or figures in front of them. And it's incredible mental arithmetic.
Taylor's here now.
Hello. I just would like everyone to know that the reason that I didn't actually hear when Christina called me the first time is because my phone has been on vibrate since the first thing I did this morning was go to a 10:35 showing of Game of Shadows. And never turned my phone back on. So, go me.
We're talking about Reichenbach at the moment.
Yes.
How very beautiful it was. And fabulous. Yeah.
It was quite wonderful.
My favorite part had to be when it was sort of like you could see the cogs turning in Sherlock's head. Like, he decided that he was going to make the sacrifice when Moriarty's like, I'll make sure I get, like, I pay John back for this. And that's when he's like, okay, all games are off. That was just, it was a beautiful moment. It made me happy. And then we sad.
My favorite moment is the fact that as soon as Watson opened the door, and he just looked at Watson and fall and close his eyes. And I was like, this is the last thing he's going to see. Oh, my God.
Sorry. That was just adorable. Like, there's no way around it. It was like, it was also very moving. I mean, I think that the angsty bits are much more poignant in the Ritchie films than the campy bits. And that was beautiful. That was really cool.
Yeah.
And no matter whether you ship them or not, that's really, really pretty, just the idea that this is the one person I want to remember, and I'm doing this for you.
It was too sweet. Yeah.
Should we gradually switch toward the relationship between Holmes and Watson, or should we not go there?
I don't think that we can talk about the movie without talking about that. You make it sound like that's possible to just avoid.
Yes, because it's not subtext anymore. It's just text. At this point, it's
there.
Text.
And I think
in the Ritchie universe, it's text.
Yeah, in this steampunk land alternate universe, it is sunshine and glitter and rainbows and unicorns. And I think you retweeted it, Lindsay. It was like, I turned to my friend, I'm like, this is the gayest movie I've seen, and I've seen movies.
I've seen.
Yeah. Well, these two are really playing it as well. They're just literally
self-aware they are of it, though. They're like, we know what people say. And I think Robert, he's talked about this in interviews, like, very point blank. He's like, dude, whatever. Doesn't matter. This is how we're playing their relationship. And it's...
I love how unwilling he is to kowtow to any sort of queer-hating faction of the, like, 13 to 30-year-old demographic machine who don't even notice it and love the films. And if they do notice it, maybe they like it. Like, it doesn't bother anyone. And I think that it's fantastic that during all of the press conferences that I've seen him do, he only plays it up more because that's, you know, if nothing else, he's raising tolerance of superheroes who might not happen to be heterosexual. So, fantastic.
It's quite funny because, like, what I was saying in really short is that when I saw the movie on Friday, I was quite excited about it. And I think when it kind of fell on me a few days later, I was like, oh my God, the homoerotic thing in this movie is just so blatantly obvious. It's actually going to the point where you just go like, Are we gonna get something at one point in anything, this movie or anything else? Because this is becoming a trend, so I'm getting tired of it. But it's true. It's becoming a trend. I can go on forever, and I'm not gonna do that. But it's just it's both fun, and it's obviously it has an audience, so they're really playing with it. But at the same time, just go like, for fuck's sake, they dance together.
That was an amazing scene, though.
Like, how far can you go in terms of what you actually want to say? You know, it's just, come on.
That's where I just started shaking my head myself.
There's one of the extras in that scene in the background that the look on his face is brilliant. He's just like, what? Why?
No one told me.
Because almost nobody else is, like, reacting to it. One of the dignitaries in the background looks, like, appalled.
I'll have to look for that next time. Because I was too busy going, what? What is this movie? What? What is happening? Like, I was literally saying that in the theater. Like, what is going on?
I feel kind of bad for being, like, I think I'm probably the only person who saw it that I know at the same time, you know, because I went with you before. When it occurred to you, I'm like, that would be so, you wouldn't do that to him because you'd be thrown in prison. And I find that part of the alternate universe thing I get, and I like it. I get the steampunk alternate universe. And I like all of it. I really enjoyed the movie, and like, I don't want to get all political about it at all, but if that was Victorian England, you would be getting your best friend in serious trouble. And they ignore any sort of ramifications of the fact that, you know, this was during the same period that Oscar Wilde's doing a major stint in Reading Jail.
Mm-hmm.
Or being queer. And I think that the movie ignoring that entirely just firmly places it in an alternate universe. Does that make any sense?
Yeah.
Yes. Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. We're going in a completely different dimension because there is not a single person that's in shock during the whole
thing.
Except for that guy.
Nobody even reacted to it, and that really annoyed me.
That's really the only reason I think I noticed that guy is because they started dancing, and instead of watching them, I wanted to see what the reaction was, and then it wasn't fun.
And at the same time, you can't help but feeling giddy about how completely ridiculous it is. And at the same time, all of us are always like looking for the tiny thing where you just go, what is that?
No, this isn't Victorian England. This is Switzerland. Anything goes there.
They're
out of the country.
They're in neutral territory.
But they're also, you know, and they're not only would it be weird enough, like you were saying, Lindsay, that it would be a really horrible position to put each other in, more or less. But they do it in a room full of dignitaries. This isn't like they're in the pub.
This is what I'm saying.
There was a scene in Torchwood where they did that in the 40s, and the reaction of everyone else was completely breathtaking because everyone was like kind of like, what the hell are they doing? And that was really well played, and I expected something like that, and that just didn't happen. I was bizarro world.
It is bizarro world, and I loved how charming it was and how campy it was and how they leave it open to some degree of interpretation as well, but there's no tie back any sort of Victorian reality once I saw that, because neither of them would do that to each other. They'd be ruined completely.
Yeah, that was the end of it. That was like the line. You just cross the line. You just go, oh, well, whatever. We're just so far gone now.
I don't think I've ever seen the Ritchie movies as being, you know, historically accurate. Ever.
Oh, God. Coming from Ritchie? Never.
No. So I guess I never ever thought in that way, but yeah, like I was saying, like I was looking for a reaction. I'm like, nope, there's nothing. Okay, I'll just enjoy the dancing. It's fine. Jude Law looks amazing in a tux. It's great. that's where my mind went.
That we could probably switch to another scene from there, which is the train scene.
Oh god.
with Holmes's legs between Holmes's head between Watson's legs, you mean?
Yes.
And throwing Mary off a train.
Yeah.
Which was so ridiculous.
but that's one of the things that really...
I did like that, like, Watson immediately pounced on him and was like, did you just kill my wife? It's just like he wouldn't put it past Holmes to just do that. That's kind of scary.
I like the fact that he emphasizes the word new. Did you just kill my new wife? Like, is it?
I agree. I was like, why new?
Like, this, are you referring to Holmes as the first one?
Oh, well done.
Oh, I see what you did there.
One of the things that I thought actually was quite, again, I'm going back to Marie because I kind of, I don't know, there was some stuff there. The fact that, you know, he just threw her outside of the train. And when we switch back to that scene where Mycroft comes and pick her up, and she's kind of like casually saying, oh my God, there are two of you guys. And she's just going in the, and she's like, well, whatever, you know, coming from those two, I expect anything. And in a way, it's a bit sad that he didn't develop that further, even if we know she's quite understanding. She's not just understanding. She's like, she's completely, you know, she's cool about it. And I don't know, I kind of liked it, but at the same time, I wish I had seen more of that coming from her, you know, more scenes with
there
Mary.
There needs to be more leading up to the fact at the end when he speaks of her, when Holmes speaks of her as a colleague at the end. I thought it was so cheap because basically you have him throwing her off a train, then you have her visibly at his brother's house in a scene that was so, like, gratuitously lowbrow, I don't even...
Yeah, how do you do that to Stephen Fry? Come on.
Oh my God.
And then, at the end, it's like, hey, BT Dub, she's a colleague, we love girls, woot!
Yeah.
I would have loved more.
Well, I love her character. I really do. I love what they do with her, and I would really like to see more of her.
Yeah, me too.
If Rachel McAdams hadn't been in the film, but if it had been some sort of storyline that involved Mary Morris even more than she was already involved, it would have made so much more sense in my head. The whole thing.
Yeah,
instead they sort of split the difference and nobody really is invested in either of them. Although I like her a lot. I think that Mary
Am I the only person that got really excited when Adler died? Because that's...
We talked about that earlier, before you were here. But excited, no. I would not say that was our reaction.
Not exactly, no.
It got a little girl power-y.
Oh, good.
Yeah. It turned all, why are girls dead?
Okay, that's a good summary. Yeah. Well, I'm sorry, I don't like Rachel McAdams, so that's probably a lot of it.
I can say, I mean, two people in that podcast can say that, thank God, Irene in the BBC version is pretty epic, I have to say.
Oh, so,
yeah. God, yes.
She's, yep. So that's probably going to be a good reminder that you can write Irene the good way.
Yeah.
Like Doyle did back in the day.
Yes.
And about Mycroft, what
even? Yeah.
What the hell?
Why did they do that?
And coming from Stephen Fry, I'm sorry, but I'm actually quite offended because I'm like, dude, you should have known better. You're like, you know what I mean? It's like, he's a Sherlockian. He likes Sherlock Holmes as well. So, I don't know. If it had been me, I would have been like, okay, this is just not on. This is not Mycroft at all. But I think it really cheapens.
Something similar, I think, must have happened when he signed up for a bit of Fry. Well, post a bit of Fry and Laurie. They asked Fry and Laurie whether they would do Dean and Wooster. And the two of them apparently looked at each other when they were being cast for these roles, and they said, well, no, we're really not experienced enough as comedians, and we couldn't possibly, and we don't think that we can do this, and it's not going to work. And then basically the producers of the project said to them, well, if we're not going to do it, we're going to do it with other people. And they said, okay. So, we'll do it then. I feel like maybe Stephen Fry just thought, I've been offered the chance to play Mycroft Holmes in a major motion picture, and this is what Mycroft Holmes looks like in that motion picture, so does that make sense?
Yeah, that's a good point.
But Stephen Fry, you'd think he wouldn't let himself be like, he had to have known it was shit. I mean, because I think Mycroft, he needs to have this sort of, like, not necessarily sinister, but he has to have sort of this gravitas, because... what he does, like, for, like, the British government, like, he is this incredibly, like, shadowy kind of figure, and in this, he's just, like, he's walking around naked. That's who you are.
I think to be honest with you, except for that scene, it would have been okay, but the whole naked scene made it so cheap. I was like, oh my God, this is pathos, you know, this is just comedy.
I didn't
comedy.
Like him in any of the scenes. I was just like, he doesn't hold my attention. He doesn't, give off that Mycroft vibe, and I don't know if I've just been, you know, spoiled by the canon than Mark Gatiss's portrayal. Like,
I was going to say that. I think Gatiss has ruined it for everyone now.
good. The Vanilla Minecraft also is very good.
I haven't seen any of those with him yet.
Charles Gray, is that his name?
Oh my god, yeah, he's like a giant toad. He's amazing.
Yeah, for me, the Minecraft thing was, it was probably the thing I was most excited about, so it was the hugest letdown.
Yeah.
Definitely. I was like, Stephen Fry, and then he happened, and I was like, oh, that's it? Okay.
It was just really camp. But there was a lot of camp stuff in the movie. I think it's...
Yeah, but at least there's substance to most of the camp.
Oh, yeah, of course. Yeah. I thought it was quite obvious as well in the whole transvestite disguise scene in the train as well. It's quite funny how, having seen the movie 2 times, I could see that Stanley Jr. went really, really camp in the way he was playing Holmes in that. These ones, even in the way he talked, the way he was speaking and the way he was playing, still kind of half disguised, half Holmes. I was like, wow, this is really, really, really camp. It was just really strange. I don't know. Again, probably acting choice.
You're right. He kind of stayed in the character of the disguise.
Yeah, but I don't know if he was it was some kind of inception joke of his character itself. Of again, this is we're talking about Robert Downey Jr. It's a guy who has been in movies. I mean, if I have to name a few, he did exactly the same thing Iron Man 2 as well, which is he kind of switch where you don't really know if it's the actor or the character anymore. And he does that a few times when he does this kind of very excessive characters. So I'm not surprised, but I feel like with Holmes, you have to kind of hang in there and not go too far because it gets really obvious really fast. Well, can we talk about Jared Harris for a minute?
Yes.
Because I love him.
Please.
He was amazing. And I don't know for you guys, but there were moments where I could totally see his father in the way he was playing as well, which, you know, I'm a big fan of. And I was just like, oh my god, this is just, it's a really cool performance. And I quite like what you said, Lindsay, in your review of the movie, how, he actually has more meat than, I mean, the very, very thin canon Moriarty, obviously. But I kind of like what they did with him, you know, like how they kind of build up this whole persona of, putting it in this kind of steampunk war, thingy, which is really cool, and how he would try to be the super villain and just have, you know, everything in his hands, basically being the big boss of everyone. And Jared Harris is like so creepy. He's just really creepy.
He was pretty much perfection in that role.
Yeah. Yeah. Very subtly so, I feel. Like, he didn't go over the top and do, like, the mad cackle. Like, he was very subdued, but very legitimately scary, like, with what he could do. And most of it was, like, mind games. And I love the scene where he tricks Holmes and there's just the chess piece in the opera. I'm like, that is so good.
Yep. And the opera. Oh, my God.
It was also terrifying because to hear Sherlock Holmes say these 3 words, I was mistaken.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That is just, excuse my French, freaking terrifying.
Again, it's another thing about the whole, this is the dark hour for Holmes. This is where everything collapses, and this is the time where he makes the mistakes as well. And also at the end, during the torture scene, when he's singing and everything. This is such a
thing.
This is one of the things that where Richie is actually really good at, because he's done it in other movies. He's really good at this kind of very brutal male kind of know, just strong violence. He's really good at that, but it's really hard to put it in something that is supposed to be family friendly. But I could totally see him, you know, like the old guy Richie sweating through the whole concept of the family movie in that specific scene, and he worked so well. It was brilliant. I really loved it. It was creepy as hell as well.
Yeah, the singing was good. Like, the torture scene in general. Like, and I liked how it was parallel, because they had that going on. And then, of course, Watson versus Moran.
Oh, yeah, that was great.
So good.
Also, the song that they used, I mean, for me, it was incredibly powerful, because I'd heard the soundtrack before, and the soundtrack version that I had just a generic version of the track, the Schubert song. Okay. So it didn't actually have all the creepy sound effects that the actual track has. But, like, I was listening to the soundtrack while I was walking around town, and the child came on, and it actually stopped dead in my tracks, and I was like, holy shit, what are they going to do? And then, obviously, that scene happened, and for me, it was really powerful, because that song is, you know, it's that little innocent song that you learn at primary school in Germany. You know, it's kind of like in, what's the film? Clockwork Orange, when he sings Singing in the Rain. Mm. It had that kind of emotional power. It was, yeah, it was quite something.
Oh, well, can I? I'm just going to say something as well, because there is a bit of French in that movie, and I have to give it to Ritchie, because they actually got a proper French actor to do what's his name, Ravache. And it did, because most of the time when they hire, you know, people to do French people in this movie, in this kind of movie, they're just kind of English people speaking French, or they're just, the French is terrible or anything. And that actually was really good in the movie. So thank you for that. I liked it.
Yeah, but sadly enough, the Germans were all fake Germans, and one bit of the subtitles was actually a false translation.
So they got,
you know, yeah, there's a bit where one of the guards says, there's too many foxes for you, something. And I don't know what the subtitle was, but it was wrong, because what he actually said was, there are too many foxes for you, chickens, in German. And the subtitle said something like, there's too many foxes for you, Hansel. And that's actually what the track is called as well on the soundtrack, which makes no sense, really, at all, because I don't know who did that.
Yeah, when they started speaking the other languages, I thought about you guys. I'm like, I wonder if they're actually saying what they're supposed to be saying. I don't know. Yeah, so Jared Harris was magnificent, and it made me happy that he was ginger.
Yes.
I didn't think of that, of course.
Yeah.
Anything is better than the canon version.
That's true. Very true. Yeah, canon Moriarty's kind of like...
I really liked how the parallel was set up between Holmes and Watson on the one side, and Moriarty and Moran as their antithesis. I mean, they go to the opera to see Don Giovanni.
Yeah.
What Holmes and Watson do in the first film, you know. And it kind of goes down from there. And I really liked how Moriarty was, you know, this respectable professor with his neat office and, you know, the dynamics of an asteroid and all that. And you compare that to Holmes, whose home life is incredibly messy, but who creates order in the world.
Right.
You know, whereas Moriarty has this sort of neat office life and, you know, is respectable and perfect to the outside, but, you know, is the spider in the web of dastardly crime. I thought that was quite nice.
Agreed. And very well stated.
I also like how, like, when Moran first appeared, like, that's who I thought it was, but I wasn't sure, and then he just kept appearing. I'm like, oh my god, it's you, is it?
Yeah, I flared a little bit when it was Watson who actually said his name.
Yes. I was like, yes.
That's a cool scene when he's on the roof and you just kind of go into deduction time.
Yeah, that was...
And I really like that. I like the whole interaction and dynamics in that scene, even with the three characters work really well. Like, everyone is looking around and everything. I wish there was more of that in some of the scenes in the movie. Quite like it. Can I just say also something about the music? I'm sorry, it's completely cinema related, not Sherlock Holmes related, but again, thank you, Hans Zimmer, because that bloody good. I mean, he does. I'm a huge soundtrack fan, and Zimmer tends sometimes to kind of copy himself. You know, he's doing plagiarism of his own work. But even if there is a bit of Gladiator in there, I think the soundtrack is actually really, really cool. And listening to it outside of the movie, it's really, really good. So.
Yeah.
There's one other thing I wanted to point out, just because I thought it was good and it should put that antithesis thing going on. When Moriarty's, like, you know, in the rubble because, you know, a building fell on him. And Moran is, like, digging through. He's, like, so, like, intense. He's like, I'm going to go get them because they hurt you. And, like, and I just love that, like, how you said, Arlie, just, like, that balance. And, like, they're, like, they have the same sort of, like, relationship partnership going on, but just completely, like, different extremes.
And it's kind of like in the BBC version, I could see that, you know, Sherlock and Jim Moriarty could easily have been each other. And in this version, I felt the same about Watson and Moran, because, you know, they have this very similar background. They were together in Afghanistan and whatnot. And, you know, Moran has this beautiful London accent. I don't know if I were Watson, I'd probably be like, yeah, well, that could have been me, you know. It's him just on the other side of the law.
Which is much better storytelling than the original Doyle does. I always, you know, I harp on it, but it's just weird how bad a short story The Adventure of the Final Problem is. It goes against every, because he wanted Sherlock Holmes to die. That short story is not storytelling. It's, I'm gonna go ahead and kill Sherlock Holmes right now, like a chicken on a block. Like, it's rough to read, because, you know, suddenly here's a, have you ever heard of Professor Moriarty, Holmes says to Watson. No. Well, okay, here's a good sign that we're not really myth-making right now. So, This is my arch nemesis, so maybe, I don't know, my partner in Daring Do would probably have heard him by this. It's so weird, and it's not at all weird when you know that Doyle just wanted to be dead. But then the way people retroactively sort of take Moran, who's only in the empty house, that's it. He's not even, I think he's in the final problem in the sense that he sort of looms in a amorphous sense, but really Colonel Sebastian Moran, Holmes is afraid of Aragorn's in the final problem because of Moran, but Moran, I don't think we ever see him physically, and we only see Moriarty from the train. So like these later adaptations, like the BBC Sherlock version and like the Ritchie version with the super creepy Jared Harris, who's like, I agree, is amazing, are really interesting because that's actually good storytelling in terms of creating a heroic mythos around the person, as opposed to, yeah, there was this elderly mathematics professor, and I'm sorry, but he threw Superman off a cliff, and Superman forgot how to fly.
I liked at the Reichenbach, while we're talking about Jared Harris, how they did sort of like the double deduction thing about like going like out.
Yes.
I was like, that is good. That is good. Good filmmaking right there.
The whole fight was in their heads.
Yeah. Sick.
That was really cool.
And then it just turned to that simple, like, sacrificing myself, eyes closed. Just last thing you see, Watson. Beautiful, beautiful, beautiful.
I really like that you kind of got to see that twice, because even that idea of Holmes going through the deductions and then the deductions coming out wrong.
Yeah.
Like, in the scene where the fight happens at Watson's stag party, and he's got the whole plan to get the Cossack down and beat him up. And
beating
she just
him up
throws
with the
a
umbrella.
Knife at him. Yeah, and she just throws a knife at him and derails the entire train of thought mid, like, what he's doing. And that's kind of interesting to see how it's not necessarily, you know, he can see these things and he can do these actions, but it's not always necessarily going to go according to plan.
Again, this is Holmes' darkest hour. Everything is fucked up.
Yeah, and I mean, and that is kind of like, it's much darker in tone than the first film, because in the first film, you know, even when they get hurt and when Watson gets a shoulder wound and all that stuff happens, you know, they're never in serious danger. Whereas in this one, if they get hurt, they get hurt. Like, it sticks.
Yeah. Even though it is a really, really dark, I like how they balanced it out with quite a lot of humor. Like the wedding scene, like I was peeing my pants laughing. Just, like, Watson being that hungover and, like, just attempting to, like, go to his wedding.
Just the way walk, looks the walk from the motor car with him.
Was I the only person who found that completely heartbreaking?
No, I did. I thought half of me was laughing my face off at Jude Law's portrayal of the hangover, and the other half was going, oh, my God, like, this is worse than Holmes having a meat hook in his shoulder about half an hour later.
Yeah, I mean, it's just the way, you know, the hand-holding and the looking at each other, kind of like, yeah, we have to do this thing now, and then Holmes is all alone and looking at Watson and Mary with some sort of pride, but also with this incredible sense of loss and,
that he winks at Mary.
Yeah. I like that, too.
He's kind of saying, like, it's okay. I'm really upset, but you're a good girl. It's okay.
That might actually be one of my favorite scenes.
It's really well done, that one.
It was.
It was a great balance of being an extremely emotional situation that's happening and having the correct, not over-the-top comic relief at the same time.
Yeah.
Because it's mostly funny because, like, I think everyone's, like, been there at some point being, like, that hungover and, like, but you have to do something.
Preferably not your wedding.
Preferably not your wedding, yeah.
This is why you don't have your stag party the night before you get married.
Yeah.
Yes. can we talk about the very, very, very end, which is the whole disguise thingy.
Oh, God.
I have no words for that.
Yeah.
Part of me is glad that they did that to show that he didn't actually die, but for those who, like, haven't read the canon, I was like, oh, you just gave it away.
It was very telescoped, didn't it? It's not 3 years. That's, like, a month.
Yeah. It kind of cheapens the whole dramatic effect of the fall, which the fall, the proper fall of Reichenbach Fall, was actually a very beautiful scene. It was really well done. The way he just falls with his eyes closed, it was quite powerful. And then you kind of switch and you have the whole funeral with the irregulars and everything.
I know the irregulars being there.
Oh, Clarky was there.
Clarky!
It was just beautiful. And then you switch to the office, and he's just writing. And in about 3 or 4 minutes, suddenly Holmes is prancing around in this ridiculous outfit, and he's like, "Ooh, I'm back." And I was like, I'm gonna stick to the Empire Strikes Back for that. I kind of like my angst until the end and resolve it in the next movie.
They cheated Campbell, Marie. In principle.
Yeah. You know what I mean? It's just, yeah. I think it's probably because this is the kind of movie where they have to take into consideration they might not make the next one, which
I
could happen.
I thought they were already confirmed for that, though.
Supposedly they have a writer, but I haven't heard.
This one cost a lot of money. It cost one fifth more than the previous one, and the box office so far is less than the first one.
I don't know if there's
going to be another one, but that's the exit route. If we can't do the third one, we didn't leave the people hanging in there, you know, with just this kind of death thingy. So you have to resolve it, but resolving it in like 3 minutes at the end of the movie with the cheap gag, it was like, oh my god, no.
Like, I have a theory about this. My theory is that Sherlock was there just to make sure Watson was okay, and that he doesn't actually stay there. Like, he runs off after that. He just wanted to check up on him. That's my theory anyways.
It's okay. A good one, yeah.
Yeah.
So if they do a third one, I imagine it will go via the empty house, yada yada.
Mm. I was shocked, actually, when I went to see it. It was on the Friday night that it came out, and it was in a massive theater that was probably half full. I mean, I was really surprised, because it was a Friday night, et cetera. I mean, I know there's all the holiday doings and goings on, but I've heard the same thing about the box office for the new one kind of falling off a bit from the first, which is a shame, because it's a very entertaining movie. No matter whether you agree with bits and pieces of it.
Well, you know, I think there are a lot of movies coming out at the same time as well.
Dragon Tattoo came out. And
yeah.
Mission Impossible came out, which I was a bit.
Well, I hope it works. I hope it works. It works well though, because I still think I had a great time watching it, and it was really cool. And I would totally watch a third movie. I would definitely sit for a third movie. So
me too. And they did set up the empty house sort of in a very subtle way with the wax bust.
They did. Mm. Yeah.
That made me real happy, excited. I was like, it's the bust.
That was really cool. Like, just canon references. The bust is there. Like, that was really neat. And it didn't do anything in this film. I hope it does in another one. I hope they make it. It'll be really good to see where it goes.
And, I mean, let's be honest. We need to see more tree being harassed by Guy Ritchie as well. I'm sorry, but we have started something here, and it cannot be abandoned. It has to go.
Save the trees.
This is a whole new level.
Tree genocide in the Ritchie film.
Yeah, kill all the trees. Kill all the trees!
Explode, not just kill them, like explode them into a million
pieces. Explode the tree in slow motion toward the camera.
Yes, as if the destruction of the tree is somehow warranted by hateful, vile acts on the trees. When it was a mere sapling, I don't even know.
It's true, I mean, let's just take a minute to talk about that scene, because it is visually and in terms of cinematography, it's absolutely completely insane. It's glorious, but it's a music video. That's what it is.
Yeah.
And at the end of
Wood
the day,
Kid Iron.
Yes, exactly.
Yes, that's a great video.
Wicked Iron is the one I was going to reference. This is a brilliant slow motion video, but it's a music video. It's 5 minutes of it, and it's on purpose. And it's there are so many shots in that sequence. Which are completely like, they probably had 15 CG guy on set, and they were like, okay guys, let's sit down. How many CG tricks can we put in one scene that's gonna be completely awesome but completely useless? Let's do this shit.
But and, it was really pretty, but it had a little bit of that drag to it.
Oh yeah.
And we came out of the movie, people that I went with kind of referring to it as the mid-movie intermission, slow-motion intermission.
Oh, yeah.
Get your popcorn while the slow motion's happening.
I went with my friend Melinda, who had seen it prior to me, and this was her second time within, 3 days. And She counted 24 major explosions happening.
I was thinking about counting them, but then I got distracted.
Yeah, I know. She had to do it a second time in order to count effectively, but 24 is the figure we came up with, so.
There's literally no countryside left there.
No.
But it is quite funny though, because this is typically a sequence where if I had to go have a go at Richie's direction, I would take this one, because there are literally four intentions in that sequence. And one of them I actually really liked was the I don't know how you call it in English. It was the POV camera on Moran, who was running through the woods to actually try to get to them before everything. And that was actually quite cool. But you don't do that on one side and then wide angle shots on the other side.
It was really different.
It was just nothing was linked together, and it's basic cinematography, it's basic direction language, and I was a bit annoyed at that. I was like, okay, we get it. You have fancy tools in your hands and you have lots of CG in your hands, it's cool. But stop it.
I think the important thing here to realize is that World War didn't destroy the European countryside. It was Guy Ritchie.
More or less.
Guy Ritchie's fault.
And going back to the box office, I just pulled up the stats. Game of Shadows earned $40 million in the U.S. this weekend.
That's not bad.
Yeah. Hmm. The
first
U.K.
one something like 60.
Okay. So it's dropped off, but that's still a lot. The U.K. isn't up yet. I can't.
It's the second week that's gonna make a difference, because this is where people talk about it. I'm not gonna lie. I mean, the first time I saw it, it was fine, but the second time I saw it, it was a full cinema. And about seven people left. And you don't see that. I mean, yeah, I was a bit surprised at that. But at the same time, it's another debate about how people are getting less and less tolerant about staying in for a 2 hours movie anymore.
Also, at the same time, people left when I saw Take the Sailor Soldier Spy, like an hour in. So clearly, people leave the cinema for very diverse reasons.
I was still surprised. But then again, I still think the first 35 minutes of the movie could have been condensed in 20, because the last hour of the movie is brilliant. It just flies by. It works well. But the build-up to that is very slow, and if you don't get involved in it, this is where the people who actually didn't like the movie said they were bored, and they said that the end with the multiple almost fake ends kind of pissed them off, because they were already bored from the 45 minutes at the start. And I think it's a bit sad in a way. I was like, just edit everything. Edit.
Like, modern audiences are just expect to be entertained constantly, and they don't want to wait. And I think it's really unfortunate. I think that just has to do with, like, the age of technology, and, like, everyone has to be constantly, like, blah, 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 blah. Yeah. People don't know how to sit back and relax and enjoy time.
No, that's true. I mean, how many people... I mean, if you did a showing today of Gone with the Wind with an intermission and no one had ever seen it before, I would bet that most of the people that I go to the cinema with would stay through it, but not everyone would.
Yeah.
It's definitely... Yeah. But it's the same thing. I mean, I do enjoy what I call very slow movies. I'm a huge fan of Wong Kar-wai, who is the specialist...
I love him.
And Wong Kar-wai makes movies where nothing happens, but it's glorious. But if you drop that in front of some people, they can't even understand how it's cinema, because it's just because it's not active enough. So I think this is very obvious when you have, especially when you see in Sherlock Holmes, there is a lot of exposition in the movie, probably too much of it. But if you give up after 45 minutes just because there was too much of it, it's a bit sad, because it's probably, again, a direction decision, but you have to give it a try until the end. I don't know. I don't leave movies. I just stay, and then I criticize the shit out of them if it's bad. You know what I mean? I just stay, and I watch the whole damn thing. I've left probably 5 movies in my life, and they were really bad.
Can we talk about how stupidly cool those two BBC Sherlock
I was gone for the week, and I come back, and it's like everywhere. I'm like, what's going on? Something happened.
I'm so jealous of you kittens who've seen it already.
It's quite funny to see that happening now, especially for the two previews that the two video they showed, because it's like it's quite funny to see the internet reacting to it and doing an interpretation of it when you know the context of it. And honestly, it's been hysterical, because immediately it created this kind of whole vibe of new new canon, fanon, instant fanon for a lot of people. And I'm like, dude, you are so far from reality. You have no idea. And
it's, yeah, I love that people have already coined the term sheetlock.
Yeah. Really? I didn't see that. Oh my God.
It's a thing. Yeah.
It happened. It happened.
I did love the fact that they talk about the, I loved it when I saw the episode, but the scale system of Sherlock. You know, like, yeah. It's a 7, it's a 6. It's brilliant. It's just, it's so cool. And then, wow, it's gonna
be. I love the webcamming. Oh my God. I'm so excited!
Yes.
My heart just, like, jumped.
No, it's gonna be epic. It's such a brilliant episode, though. It's really, really good. I really love the writing on it, and I really, I think the fans are gonna love it. I can honestly say it. There's so much stuff happening in it, though. Oh my God, seriously. Just thinking about it afterward, it was crazy. So, yeah, it's going to create a lot of fangasm.
It has a reference in it. I think that on first viewing, maybe 10 people in that room got, and I was one of them, and I felt ridiculously proud.
Yeah.
Which is good.
Yeah. Lindsay will get it.
Oh, dear.
You definitely will.
I'm so excited to see any of that stuff. And I'm really happy that Pam, you were there, because you'd be the first recipients of the crack. Yeah. I'll be mainlining that episode over and over again until the Hounds of Baskerville comes out, and then I can switch it out for episode 2, season 2.
Fun fact, guys, the way that the episodes that we're recording, if we do a reaction to everyone, number 17 for the 17 steps will be Hounds of Baskerville, which I'm like, that's cool. That's cool.
Oh,
we have to do reaction episodes.
Yeah. Oh,
That's going to be ridiculous, but it's going to be brilliant.
We'll be testing our bandwidth in January. So it'll be one every week.
And how much high pitched sound can we make in one podcast as well?
Exactly. Yeah. Some of you you have much more deeply pitched, elegant voices than I do. I'm going to be more like subjective.
So, some people are going to see Baskerville on the 4th, because there is a screening in Wales. There was a screening that was scheduled by the BAFTA. So, I think, there is a screening followed by a Q&A with Moffat, Gatiss, and Sue Virtue as well. So, it means for about 3 days there might be a bunch of spoilers around as well. So, yeah. It feels like the Baskerville is probably the less spoilery thing you could find, because it's so famous. It's so big. It's probably the book that everyone has read, so I wouldn't be worried about this one. But if I hear spoilers about the way they're going to do Reichenbach, I'm going to do a Liam Neeson. I don't know who you are, but I will find you and I will kill you. You know, it's just...
I forget who said this. It was either, I think it was Moffat or Gatiss, who said, people were complaining about spoilers, and one or the other of them said something along the lines of, these books have been out for a very, very, very long time. Like, how can you complain about us, you know, leaking salient things? I don't remember the context of it, but it was...
Oh,
it
I remember
that Gatiss on well. Twitter. Yeah, that's I remember right. that very well.
And I thought he had a point.
Well, no, it's not... No, I mean, I understand what you mean. He has a point in terms of story. But considering we have material, which is most of us know about the material... What we were talking about was not the spoiler about the story. We're talking about the spoiler about how they were going to make it. And from the moment people were publishing pictures everywhere, it was not only we had to deal with the fact we knew the story, but then we're starting to see how it's going to look like.
No,
and I was like, yeah, it was just, I don't want to see anything. I know the story. I really don't want to see anything at all. I just want to be and go into this episode completely with a fresh eye, because it's painful as it is.
Apparently, yeah. Though, the context in which he'd said that was a slightly different one than the one that I originally thought that it was, which was what you just said, was basically because people had asked him and had said, you know, what's going to happen? Give us all the spoilers. And he was like, well, you know, the book's been out since 1897 or whenever, so, you know, just go and read that.
Yeah.
And in that context, it actually made a lot more sense. But originally, I didn't know the context, and I got very upset, and I made a very long Tumblr post. But yeah, the original context was actually, you know, more harmless than that.
We want to enjoy this episode. If you give us all the behind the scenes in the magazines and all the story already, well, we pretty much, we know everything. That's it. Final.
Yeah, thanks to the Sun and everyone who posted pictures about it, printed them. It's like, ow.
Daily fail.
Daily fail. Daily. I don't know if they do a special preview of Reichenbach. I don't think they will.
Oh, I don't think you should.
I hope not.
I don't think
so. I think this is an episode that should be seen by people on the go.
I'm gonna be a puddle. I'm gonna be a fucking puddle on my floor that my cats are gonna like lick the edges of to see if I,
I think it's gonna be really, really heart wrenching.
Well, Aldi and I are watching it together because she's gonna be around, so we're probably gonna be just crying like babies.
Can I come with you?
Oh yes,
I don't wanna be by myself.
No. Oh really? Or maybe we should go to your place then.
Yeah, come to my place.
Oh yeah, here we go. That's a deal. Done.
I was definitely engaged during the time the episodes were airing, and this year I'm just fucking clearing my schedule. I'm like, don't talk to me. I don't care who you are. BBC Sherlock is here. Right now.
I haven't decided what I'm going to do yet. Usually, my group of friends that we all watch Doctor Who together, mm-hmm. we wait until the Sunday that we usually meet up and watch the episode of Sherlock. I don't think I can do that now.
No,
I just don't.
No. It must be done immediately.
This is kind of a testament to the Richie universe versus the BBC Sherlock universe, though, because I had an invitation to a screening on Wednesday to Game of Shadows before it was out in theaters at midnight on Thursday. And I had already agreed to go to a Christmas party, and I just didn't change my plan. It was an important Christmas party for me to go to. It was somebody that, is involved in my professional life and that I care about, but if it had been BBC Sherlock, I would have lost my shit that it was on the same night. Yeah. And I really enjoyed Game of Shadows, and I needed to review it, et cetera, but I didn't feel the need to cancel plans to go to a Christmas party in order to see a preview screening of it. Mm-hmm. And, that's not my emotion when it comes to BBC Sherlock.
I literally, I'm gonna use this very, very overused, phrase to say how I felt when we sat in the theater to watch the preview of Scandal. I think my heart stopped beating. Seriously. I literally stopped breathing. I was like, I'm gonna die right now. I just can't handle this shit.
Rainbow literally shot from my eyes.
I was just dying. And you know what's really funny is that I was sitting just behind Roger Johnson from the Sherlock Holmes Society. I talked to him later on. And literally, we actually mentioned it, but all of us heard that really, really obvious gasp of kind of just everyone just stopping, just like, oh my god, this is happening, this is it. And then you just switch and you get into the episode and then you don't have time to think about anything else.
I just can't imagine how it's going to be on New Year's Day with all of us together. Oh. I know I'm just going to be vibrating, and I sincerely apologize if either of you are near me, because I'm just going to not be able to stop moving.
Soon.
Yes,
soon.
Not long to wait now.
Yeah, bloody hell.
Which is just weird to think about, because we've been waiting for so long.
It doesn't feel real at all to me.
Yeah.
Something is going to happen.
It didn't add the preview until I actually had the ticket in my hand, and then again, it's like, we were the preview, but we didn't actually have an air date that day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So until, the next day, somewhere around 3 p.m. or something, Margate tweeted, yeah, it's confirmed, we have Sherlock on New Year, and I just went, oh my god. It's actually real. It's actually going to happen. This is not a test.
It's just not a test. It's just so funny, though, because it goes so fast. It's like, first, 8th, 15, DVDs are on the 22nd. I'm like, wow, that is brutal. It's like, it's literally the highest high on drug you can get, and then it's going to be like major depression for everyone.
Yeah, then it's just waiting again.
Yeah. Well, hopefully, considering timings and stuff, hopefully they're going to be able to do the same thing they did this year in terms of filming.
Yeah.
And they're probably going to stick to that kind of thing, which will be a December, a January screening for now. But they can't do 1.5 years again. We're going to die, especially after Reckonback. I can't.
Oh, my God. Yeah.
Yeah,
Empty
House has come after that. Much faster than Doyle gave us. Can you imagine, walking around in the 19th century thinking Sherlock Holmes was dead for good?
No, it's just, I mean, in terms of, I was, because I keep saying that, I ended up investigating it for real. And it is, in terms of a successful first season, that was supposed to have sequels that took a long time to happen. It's one of the longest yeses in TV, that was that ever existed, because you had some crazy hiatus between, you know, seasons, like season 3, season 4, or like a show that died and then was revived and everything. But 1.5 years after something so short, which is 3 episodes, on a very short period of time, extremely successful, award-winning show, and then it's not even 1.5 years, it's 1 year and, no, it's 1.5 years. It's actually extremely long. It's one of the longest ones you could find, especially in modern TV. And people keep saying, well, you're just saying that. And I'm like, no, I'm not. It's actually pretty bad.
They're trying to dodge that bullet, though, by saying that they're a series of 3 short films as opposed to being a series at all.
Well,
nice try, BBC.
It's not going to work.
I don't think it works either.
Oh, well.
Right, lovelies, I need to go.
Me too. I'm actually leaving to France in about 7 hours.
Bon voyage.
Merci beaucoup. Have some great Christmas holidays. Have a great time.
Bye, Noel. It was so nice to meet you, Artie and Marie. Thanks for letting me chat. And edit me out, too.
Edit everyone out except for me.
And don't edit out, like, in a way that makes sense. Just edit out you responding to other people's questions. Just, you're right. Silence.
Do you live in or near New York City? Are you a Sherlockian or perhaps a Holmesian? Then Sherlock NYC is the group for you. Sherlock NYC was started back in October of this year and is made up of fans based in New York City. The group gathers in the city to celebrate Sherlock Holmes, Dr. John Watson, and the universe created by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle in its many forms. Whether it is movie outings or meeting for dinner and discussion, the group's goal is to meet fellow enthusiasts and share insights on all the different universes of Holmes and Watson. And right now, Sherlock NYC is working 24/7 in preparation for their first major event. On January 6th and 7th, 2012, the group invites you to join them for a multitude of Sherlock Holmes fun in New York City for the weekend. The weekend kicks off on Friday, January 6th, with a movie outing to see Sherlock Holmes: A Game of Shadows. And for those of you living under a rock, this is the new Guy Ritchie production of the Robert Downey Jr. and Jude Law version of the Holmes universe. The fun continues on Saturday, January 7th. The day starts off with a luncheon from 11 a.m. to 2:30 p.m. The event includes lunch, discussion, and Sherlock-themed games, including a murder mystery written exclusively by Sherlock NYC. After the luncheon, the group will present their main event, a screening of BBC Sherlock Series 1 in its entirety from 4 p.m. to 10 p.m. During the event, the group will hold their 12 prizes of Sherlock drawing for amazing prizes from and inspired by BBC Sherlock, with such favorites as Sherlock Scarf and the elusive John Watson Crazy Cat Jumper. And we know which babes own that. For full details on other projects and to RSVP for these events, or to sign up to enter the 12 prizes of Sherlock drawing by January 5th, please visit them at www.sherlocknyc.com. Hope to see you there.
Hi, this is Curly, and I just want to say Jen's just really jealous of my jumper. That's all. Happy Christmas!
If this quotidian world has got you crying, want you to